As a minister, as a practitioner, as a parent, as a human being, we are always asked by our youngsters, "Daddy, how far should I go if a boy wants to be friends with me?" Or the little boy says, "Daddy, how far should I go when Margie wants me to do everything, you know? How far should I go?" And when you ask your aunt or your uncle or your cousin or somebody that's a little older, and you're just 13 years old, which is a very respectable age at starting to think in that direction. And so, you say, "How far should I go?" And you want to immediately answer the question. But that's not the question, is it? The question is not, "How far should I go?" But the question is, "What are my values? What is my opinion of my body? Is my body the temple of the living God? Do I respect it? And what is the purpose of being able to have sex or being able to have babies? That's a very wonderful divine purpose. Now, is using my sex machine, my body, as a experience of having sex before I get married, is that wrong? Is that evil? Is that bad?" And it all depends on the society and the culture you live in. And if it depends on the society and the culture that you live in, then it is not categorically good or bad. It's only good or bad according to the society you're living in. So we have no great moral, criminal, godly, threatening action for any type of moral action like that. And I think if you start out like that, with that point of view, when you talk to youngsters and to yourself, you'll have a whole different attitude toward what should I do, how far should I go. Now, when a child goes to church and you give him offering money, and he takes that offering money and doesn't put it in church, in fact, sometimes doesn't even go to church, and goes down to the corner store and spends it on candy and things, and feels so, "No, God wanted me to have this, you know, that's why I put it in my hands." There's all sorts of rationalizations for that. But you feel bad. You feel dirty. You feel you have stolen money. It's not enough that you don't spend it. You don't feel bad enough you don't spend it. But you feel bad. And when you compound that, after a while, your moral structure, your value system decays considerably. First time is bad enough, but each subsequent time that you do it, your values take a nosedive right down in the dirt. Now, in other countries, in other worlds, perhaps that is not an unacceptable thing to do. But here it is. And you chose to be born here, you chose to be born in this society, you chose to be born in this culture that has these values. And the value is motherhood, family, country, and first of all, God. And what does it mean to value motherhood? Well, that means that the operation of sex, the activity of sex, is designed for procreation. Now, is that all that people do who get married, have procreation sex and no other kind of sex? Well, if we were to say that, that would be asinine. Because sex as a thing, as a tool, as a sharing, a loving experience, is not bad. But if you feel at any time that any of these things are wrong, then it's bad for you. It's not that it's bad by the world, the universe's conditions, but it's bad for you. If you think to go into your mother's room and steal her cosmetics, stealing, to use her cosmetics, that this is a bad thing, that it's evil, that's your mother's stuff, you wouldn't want your mother pawing through your stuff, then if you do it through her stuff, you haven't a leg to stand on. You've thrown out your moral righteousness right out the window. So when you have values, when you have reasons for doing things, when you believe in yourself and you follow them, you feel very good about it. Now, I'm unusual, I imagine, at least people tell me I am. My mother and father always said, you have sex after you get married. And so, at the age of 25, I got married, and I had sex. And it was just fine. And I wasn't all tied up about it before that, trying to have the experiences. I wasn't all tied up and upset about it, because I knew where I was standing. I knew what my values were. I had not had this as some great desire that I wished to have, that I needed to fulfill my nature. I never had that as a thought. So that was not something, but I was taught by my mother and father in very gentle ways, not with a threat, not with any coercion of any kind, just, hey, wait until you get married to have sex. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. Wait until you get married. And I did, and most of the other in the family did too, and that was beautiful. But if I had not, if I had gone out and done something, having been brought up with those attitudes, I would have felt very bad. I would have perhaps done like a lot of people and felt that sex was dirty. I would have felt that sex was evil, that you only do it in the dark or undercover, and you only do it when nobody's watching, you know. And that's a terrible thing. That's a terrible attitude to have about any activity in your life, that any activity in your life is bad. People think that when they sit on the pot and they wipe their bottom, that this is dirty and they should never be seen in public doing this. It's the most natural thing in the world. And you're urinating, this is terrible. You should never do that. Or you're taking a shower. It should be done in private. Now, I'm not saying that these things shouldn't be there. What I'm saying is, if you do those things, if you do those things out in the open, you feel bad about it, because this is the culture you've been brought up in. The culture of being covered. The culture of being ashamed of your body. Not ashamed to shame, but thinking that you should not be out or exposed in any way. And of course, this is a silly, silly thing. This is a silly, silly thing for us to build into our culture. But it is there. Now, in the Polynesian cultures, that's not the case, is it? In the Polynesian cultures, sex is something that takes place early in life, and the boy and the girl try things out to make sure who it is who is compatible with the other. And when you find two people who are compatible, especially when they can have a baby, then they get married. But if they can't have a baby, and he wants children or she wants children, then they say, hey, you know, maybe you're sterile or I'm sterile or impotent or whatever, you know. And this is very interesting, isn't it? So, what we want to do is to be very, very careful what sort of morals we base our life on, what sort of cultural traditions we base our life on, what sort of activities we base our life on. And until we do that, we'll never know. Now, we have just had an experience here. We have three dogs, and we put two of the dogs in the bathroom because the post lady was coming to the door. Ingeborg! And so Ingeborg just couldn't leave them alone in the bathroom. And so they come running out of the bathroom, barking away and talking away and talking. I want to go see the post office lady. I want to see what she got posted for me too, you know. Yeah, some lovely gesture like that. But no, we can't leave them alone and let them be quiet in the bathroom, as they always are when I put them in there at least. And then my talk is not disturbed. But here we are talking about how far should I go, whether I should have a relationship with somebody, how far the relationship should go. Am I this close? Is it my steady? Is it my one and only? Well, I say, if you feel comfortable in light of what you have been trained, of your cultural standards, of your moral standards, to do anything that you want to do, then that's fine. But if you have the slightest doubt about whether you should or not, then I would say, just wait. Now, what is the perfect indication of whether you have a doubt?
You ask the question.
If you ask the question, the answer is no. And this is truly the case. If people come up and they want special privileges, special opportunities to do things that other people are not allowed to do, because they are special people, the answer should always be no. If you let yourself get talked into saying yes, then you feel just as dirty, miserable, and evil as the person asking the question. Now, whether that person is evil, dirty, or anything like that, that's another story. But you feel that way. You feel that way. And if you feel that way, then as far as you're concerned, that's the way you are. I would recommend that you be very careful. I told you the story of my speaking to the brides-to-be up in Minneapolis, that is in Duluth, Minnesota. And there was a medical doctor, and there was a psychiatrist and psychologist, a minister and general counselor, and myself there. And the girls asked, if we have had relationships before we got married, should we tell our husbands about it after we're married? Well, all of the counselors backed off. Oh, I'm not going to give you an answer on that. I wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot pole. And I said, I will. I said, I'll embrace that. I said, if you feel that you had sex before you got married and you enjoyed it and you felt perfectly good about doing it, that's your business. You don't tell your husband how many times you wiped your bottom. You don't tell your husband the relationships that you've had before you got married. That's your total world. That was your checkout time to see what kind of a person you really wanted to have as your final mate and your perfect mate. And these days, in this day and age, sex seems to be something more common than it has been in the past. Or maybe it was not talked about in the past and just done. Quite likely that's more the case. But if you ever feel you must tell your husband about it, then you yourself feel dirty and guilty about it. You feel that you did something wrong. If you feel you must confess to your husband that you did something before you got married, then you feel dirty about it. And I recommend to you, shut up. You don't say one word to your husband about any experiences that you had before you got married. Even if you were raped, even if you had some terrible, notorious experience that just utterly shook you to your bone, your husband is coming as a beautiful being into your life, who trusts you, respects you, honors you, who worships you, and you he. And why make your marriage any tougher by having something for him to think about? She did it before we got married. She might go out and find some other guys while we're married. Is that the case? Or have you found the one that's the one that you really want? So I recommend that you just keep it to yourself. And after I finished, all the girls applauded, and the men on the platform who were supposed to know all these things, they said, that's a good answer, you know. And it is a good answer. How far should I go? Whatever you can handle. Because you're going to do it anyhow. You may as well like yourself in the process. And if you like yourself, you know how far you go. You can have total sexual relationship without having intercourse, if you so choose. And you will be totally, wonderfully satisfied. Intercourse does not make perfect sex. Intercourse is only a momentary experience that lasts for a few minutes, and you may remember it joyfully, but to have someone that you dearly loved and that you enjoyed their company and that you found a great deal in common to talk with and share with and cuddle with. That's the most beautiful thing anyone could ever have. How far should I go? You know the answer. Now, trust yourself and stand up for it. You can always put your hand out and say, no. Or you can say, yes. It's up to you. And no one will feel unkind about you. I love you. Music lightens the load. Many people have tremendous loads in their life. They have problems in their life. They have wonderment in their life. They don't know where they're going or how they're going to get there. And when they can have just some lovely music in the background, it seems to be a balancer. It just makes them feel, everything's going to be okay. Everything's going to be okay. And I think the more that we learn to have the right kind of music in the background, the more balance we have. Now, music in the background that has lyrics to it is not too good. If you have music in the background, for instance, for The Sound of Music, right away you start singing The Sound of Music and not doing what you want to be doing. But what it should do is to take that part of your consciousness that wants to get up and run and give it something to do, so that the other part of your consciousness that wants to do some work can get some work done. Now, I had this music playing under my desk all day today, and it was just so wonderful. I had total control. If the phone rang, I'd press mute. And when the phone was over, I'd press go again, or something like that. It's really quite nice. It's a handy thing to be able to do, and it's nice having it right there under my control. Now, I just poured out the work today. Now, you say, well, didn't you have music before? Yes, but I didn't have control of it, because it was way up on the shelf, and my remote control didn't always work. I had to get the remote control out like this. By the time I did that, I could have got up and gone and shut it off, you know. But it's so nice to have it available like this. Now, what sort of things does music do for us? How does it lighten our load? Music makes the mind want to dance. Now, Anita would say she feels like dancing, getting up and waltzing and doing all these lovely steps that the music calls for. But your mind subliminally is getting up and dancing. It is just romancing itself around and not thinking about any problems at all. It's a way of alienating those problems from your consciousness, just giving them no attention, and pretty soon they don't stay home, because they want to irritate somebody, they want to bother somebody, and that's why they're there doing their thing. Now, the youngsters have been listening to some pretty raucous music, and it has a tendency to be kind of tough on the little ear hairs that are inside the ear, and those hairs should vibrate with the music or vibrate with the sound, but when the sound is too strong, they lay flat and sometimes they break off. In fact, they break off very much, and this is part of the cause of tendinitis, where you have ringing in your ears, you have, you know, sounds humming and buzzing in your ear. And it's because at some time or some place in your life, you listen to very loud sound more than you realize you were listening to. Like when I worked with my dad, I'd work with Benny, and Benny, you know, working with a big concrete breaker, and he would have nothing on his head, no headphones or anything. In those days, he didn't even think of that. And he'd go, and he was all shook up. He said, come on, Herbie, you do it, you know. And I'd say, what? So I'd get over there and do it, and that big old thing, and I was just a whippersnapper, walked away with me. And Benny had to catch me and catch it, because it's a heavy gadget. It weighed far more than I did. But he just laughed as I was just sort of flying up and down in the air with the machine. But that's a nice way to get out of doing it. So I just went out and did the other things. But it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. The that is like a kind of music too. But when you inflict that upon yourself at any amount of time, you cause damage in your ears. Now, that damage repairs itself in a given time, unless you are continuous on it for a long period of time. Can you imagine going into a mine and having the dynamite blowing off in the mine, boom, boom, you know, reverberating through the walls of the mine and your head like this here. And then you go home and your wife says to you, "Well, sweetheart, what did you do today?" "Eh? Eh?" "Can't hear a word. My mind is still vibrating with all that sound." And it does. And so, if you can get away from that, you probably could right yourself. But if you're in it day after day after day after day, pretty soon you don't hear anymore. It's amazing. But so it is. Why does this happen to people? Why does this happen to people that they choose to create loud noises in their world? And some very purposefully, like the youngsters who play the boombox against their ear, bah, 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 the whole neighborhood is rocking and they're not getting enough, so they have it next to their ear. There's something going on there, something we don't know about. Maybe they're having a drug high from the sound of that music right in their ear. And it's quite possible. It's quite possible. So we have to be very careful what kind of music, what kind of sound we let into our world. Now, what kind of sound do you want to let into your world? Do you want to let in romantic sound, harmonious sound, waltzing sound? Do you want to let in clanging, banging, march-type music? Or you want to have some of the more powerful musicians, composers? Who are they? We have music that is bam, 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 you know, and that's really heavy.
Stravinsky.
Yeah, well, yeah, the Rite of Spring and so forth. You start going into these various pieces that these people play, and it boom, 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 and just blows your mind. But we want to be very careful, because we love our body. You wouldn't take a hammer and keep hitting your hand with a hammer. Some people would, of course, but you wouldn't do that because you're going to damage your hand beyond repair. Yet we do that with sound that we blast into our ear. We just don't care. And of course, you pay a big price for that. And you do the same thing without wearing sunglasses. When you're looking at the you're cutting up things with an acetylene torch, and you're looking right at the blaze going on there without having these acetylene glasses on, and you destroy your eyes in no time. And a lot of people have hurt their eyes by looking at the copy machine. You're supposed to close the top of the copy machine, because that light in there is enough to cause your eyes to go kaputz very quickly, and they tell you not to look at it. But people still do. They stand there, dun, 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 you know, watching it go back and forth, and they don't realize what they're doing to themselves. Music lightens the load when the music is well chosen. When you can have background music playing, as many organizations do it, they call it Muzak. And you rent the music. And I had music playing. Oh, yes. I was with a group of fellows in the monastery, and I had some music playing. And they came up to me and they says, "Well, Herb, you like that kind of music, huh? Is that your thing?" I said, "Yeah, that's pretty nice." "Well, you know, they play that in stores, and that's called music to shoplift by, because it is so salubrious that it just makes everybody so mellow, people don't even notice when people are shoplifting." Music to shoplift by. And I thought, oh, is that right? That's right. Well, you see, there are things you learn, things you pick up. But we want music that lightens the load of our own everyday activities and our own experiences. So find some music that really makes you happy and turns you on, and then play it and live it and enjoy it, and watch your life become much easier in every possible way, because it's a lot of fun and everybody can do it.